This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. To talk about something that is a very important part of what both of us do, although slightly outside of our specialties, and that is the late Roman military theorist and writer Vegetius. And up front, I will say neither of us is a classicist by practice, although we both have classics training in our doctoral programs. And I think, Dr. Hostler, you deal with the classics more than I do directly, given that you're a medievalist. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that at least a little bit.
I do. Because I do medieval history, much of my time is wrapped up in what we call classical reception.
Yep.
Their use of these classical texts and how they incorporate them into their own world.
Yeah, and I would say mine is more of a neoclassicism, where it's often classics, I'm doing air quotes, Renaissance, Revival, where they're, again, air quotes, rediscovering the classics, but really they're interpreting them for their own purposes, as we'll talk about. So that disclaimer said, neither of us is a classicist, but this is a text with which we are well familiar as pre-modern military historians. So let's go ahead and start just by outlining what Vegetius is. And we will be using the N.P. Milner Liverpool University Press translation for people who are interested in what we're talking about specifically. We don't know a lot about Vegetius. We know what he tells us in the text. We know this is late Roman. Do you have an opinion on what it is? I think it's either late 4th or late 5th century.
Yeah, it's a 4th or 5th century. Nobody really knows. It depends on which of the Valentinians he's writing it for, and there's three of them. So no one is quite sure. What we do know is that it has to be at least 4th century. Because of those identifications. But also what's interesting is he self-identifies as a Christian.
Yeah.
And so some people have used that to try to date it a little bit as well. But those fights, it seems like every treatment I see, you see one date or the other, and I try to stay out of that.
Yeah.
He's late Roman.
Right. Yeah, so I'll lean a little bit more on some of your expertise. When you say late Roman, or late antiquity, which is a term that is increasingly used, what do we mean by that? What is the world that he's living in like?
Right. I mean, I see it as you're at the end of the period of the so-called Western Roman Empire, right? Somewhere floating around, creeping up to its political dissolution, and we pin that number at 476 in terms of the last Roman emperor, in which after that date you have people who style themselves kings of Italy, but not these Roman emperors. So the ending of the centralized official funding for the infrastructure of Rome, the institutions of Rome, all those sorts of things. Although what my early medieval colleagues are always at pains to point out, and I tend to agree with them, is the using the word the fall of Rome, of course, is problematic for a lot of reasons, and we talk more about kind of a transition away from the classical Roman world to the early medieval, and that period being bridged by some in this concept of late antiquity. But either way, you're moving away from this Western Rome, Eastern Rome, two empire model, to something with localized political control, barbarian kings, smaller polities that are fragmented and lose that coherence.
Yeah, we know from what he says that he's writing this at the time when those groups are migrating in. He mentions, for example, the Huns by name.
Mm-hmm.
It's a four-book collection. I think there's some question as to whether or not the fourth book actually belongs, and we'll talk through what they are in a second. And it is presented as kind of an epitome of Roman military manuals, practice, maxims. Would you say that's a fair characterization?
Yeah, it is. It's and the interesting thing about it is it's anachronistic. Right. It's the world he is describing and the Roman army he's describing had not been for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So there's idealism mixed up in this as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, we're not 100% sure who he was, what he did. The suspicion is he was kind of a high official from one of these senatorial class families. We're pretty sure he wrote another book on basically horse medicine. And in this book, it's as the name suggests, Milner translates it as an epitome of military science. There are four books, and he talks about discipline in the first one. He talks about this kind of, like you said, this bygone Roman unit. He calls it the Old Legion. Then he gives a book on kind of strategy and tactics. And then there's just kind of this odd fourth book that's on naval warfare.
Right.
So let's start kind of at the end. What do you make of that naval warfare chapter, which I think it's fair to say is less analyzed than the others?
Yeah, it is. And I think if memory serves me in the big sort of strategic compendiums that we have, I don't think it's even included.
Right, yeah.
I think it's sort of left off. It can read as a bit of an afterthought. Mm-hmm. I think it's whether or not he authored it or not, I think it's useful because it gives a snapshot of a view of naval affairs in this period. Mm-hmm. When you don't, frankly, have much of that to go around. Mm-hmm. And you won't really until the Byzantines start writing about it more forcefully, really in the 10th century. So I think it's good to have. The questions of authorship are, at the end of the day, they're academic. We know that. I know, for example, I've researched and I've read personally manuscripts of Vegetius, mm-hmm, in European archives, and they include the fourth book. So from my perspective as a medievalist, I say, well, here's a 14th century codex in which a monk copied a version of the Epitome, and that monk included the fourth book.
Yeah.
So the medieval folk knew about the fourth book, and they were reading the fourth book, and that's good enough for me.
And it seems like they assumed it was part of it as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And not in a way that some texts have been problematically assembled, kind of, mm-hmm, closer to modernity. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's dive into his ideas. What would you say Vegetius's main themes or ideas are?
Well, it depends on your perspective. So I think if you are an operator, you would look at this and say, this contains all sorts of really useful, practical advice for recruiting, training, building an army, putting it in the field, marching it, keeping it organized, building camps, all of those sorts of things. It's got a nice set of warnings about problems that can occur,
mm-hmm,
which it lays out. You know, these kinds of recruits tend to be lazy. These ones are not. Mm-hmm. These are the issues that might pop up. So kind of keep your eyes open for them. It's got a bit of a troubleshooter's guide,
yep,
sensibility to it. And then an awful lot of prescriptive, tactical commentary.
Yeah, his seven formations.
Yeah, and again, this is typical, right? And I would say, you know, going into your period in the early modern, it's something you still see, you know, with marching manuals and how do you form a column and how do you do these things?
Yeah.
And this is very much of a piece with other older advice. If the most advantageous formation is this, you want, yep, to have in this on your wing, and you want to do this. But if the enemy looks like this, then you'll want to do this. And it's almost like a little checklist where you look up and say, okay, there's the enemy, sir. Well, how are they formed up? Well, they're formed up there. Okay, let me check the book. Okay, so what we need to do is, and I don't think that is always the most useful thing.
Yeah,
certainly not to operators. But I think what it does is, for when you study military theory, you can look at those and say, here's the ways they saw the battlefield. Here's how they understood the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has that element to it. But I think personally, as I said, it depends on what perspective you're from.
Mm-hmm.
As a medievalist, book three is by far more important than anything else in the entire Epitome.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of book three is the general maxims section, where he says, and here are some general thoughts as to the conduct of war. And this is where it's because of things like that I would put him in the category of a military theorist,
mm-hmm,
because he's no longer just saying, well, an army of my day should do this. he is speaking more generally, more universally about what's going on. And those are the parts that when we study medieval warfare, we tend to use to examine how those armies are acting. Those seem to be the parts, not that any of them are necessarily, and this is a big argument, is anyone picking up Vegetius, reading him and following him exactly, although there have been some suggestions for generals who have done this. But more, it's a sensibility because he describes a world in which warfare is being conducted that looks an awful lot like the medieval world.
Yeah.
And so those are the parts I tend to emphasize on those things and say, is the war you're seeing that we're studying here in the 11th century or whatever, does it resemble something like what Vegetius is talking about? Mm-hmm. And if it does not, that's kind of a launching point for discussion.
Yeah, and the maxim list, it's actually short. I mean, it's essentially mm-hmm. three pages, small pages. And it's things like bravery is of more value than numbers. Terrain is often more value than bravery.
Right.
And like I said, this kind of...
It sounds like Proverbs.
Right. Or Sun Tzu, for people who've read it, which is roughly contemporary with this. Well, it's earlier, but roughly in a very wide sense.
It's one of those things where it's, here's a list of all kinds of great advice. I was just joking yesterday to my wife about the book of Proverbs, right? I mean, you know, that's fantastic, but it's not something where when you're teaching kids the Bible, you sit down and say, now let's go through every single proverb. No, you read a few, you get the general idea, and you hit them later on, and you discover new nuggets all the time, but it's not to memorize. I'll tell you, the one that we in medieval studies really focus on, and I would say this, I would argue this carries up 16th, 17th century as well. And this is the single line, right? It is preferable to subdue an enemy by famine, raids, and terror than in battle where fortune tends to have more influence than bravery. Mm-hmm. That is kind of the key one because you're talking about a period, which there's a lot of these around the world. Your resources are finite. You have only one army. There is no conscription. There is very often you're lacking any kind of central governmental recruitment system, pay structure, whatnot. You're lucky to get the army you get, and if you lose it, you're not getting another one, mm-hmm. right? Which leads into discussions of, well, then the argument is medieval armies tended to be risk averse, mm-hmm. battle averse. You only commit when you when numbers are favoring you. And you mentioned Sun Tzu earlier. He's got that quip, that, yep. you know, kind of similar to that. But the way to win a war is positional warfare. You raid the landscape, you capture fortresses, you build fortresses, you ravage, you raid, you do those kinds of things, and you avoid battle. Because if the army is the basis of ultimately your political power, along with your treasury, you can't afford to lose it. And you don't want to risk it unless the odds are really good. So typically what we medievalists will say is, lines like that, and there are some other ones throughout the book, that's the most direct expression,
yeah.
that talk about these things. Be very careful with the resources you have mm-hmm. because you cannot replace them. Mm-hmm. And that may or may not have pertained, depending on how you're reading the late Roman Empire. You could argue some of these late imperial candidates, once you get to like the 3rd century, where they've got a legion behind them, and that's kind of it. Until they get to Rome, right? You don't have world-beating military combat power. Yeah. And so we tend to look at it through that lens. And it's not that anybody necessarily read that and said, I've got an idea. Okay. I'm going to follow Vegetius's maxim here. It's more like it's, you know, early Merovingia. And you have you're a barbarian king, and you have a small force, but so does the guy to the north, so does the guy to the west, right. And you need to marshal your resources and be very, very careful if you want to play this game.
Right, and a bishop who reads Latin.
Yes, hopefully.
Yeah. So you said this is kind of the operator's medieval read of Vegetius. Mm-hmm. Would you offer any others? Any other ways to read it that you think strike you?
You can read it as a sort of a social guide in mm-hmm. some ways, and there are some authors who have. He speaks to, I don't want to say he speaks to the question of human nature. I don't want to make him into mm-hmm. something more profound than what he is. But, you know, when he talks about, for example, the raising of soldiers, the identification and recruitment yep. of soldiers, you know, he talks about the trades. And there are people, he says, who prefer to spend their time playing dice and drinking wine and living in the city. And these are not the kind of people you want. You want someone who, you know, who's had to cut down a tree or dig a ditch. People who are used to labor. And I think that that's, it's revelatory about late Roman societies. Certainly he's not the only author to touch on matters like this. Right. If you start talking about, say you wanted to get into something like military logistics, but not even logistics, just in terms of materials and building and craftsmanship and the trades, his section about setting up camps, he's giving very precise proportions and measurements and saying this is how you do it and this is what you need to do. And so I think you can read it as, if you were to use it and say, what were people up to in this century? What kinds of jobs did they do? What kind of effort did they put into various things? What were the crafts? What were the trades? How did people live? You know, you can get a little bit from it. And I suppose you could probably do that from any piece of military theory. You could pull out your Clausewitz and say, I could read Clausewitz to get a beat on how early 19th century Prussians lived. And you could probably find enough stuff in there to say, to speak a little bit about the Prussian condition. Right. So that, that would be another way to do it. The other way is sort of the, not the operator way, but I would say the more Sir Isaac Newton way, the, something John of Salisbury is actually going to say later on himself, that you, this is the classical world. These, and this, this is a very popular Renaissance idea as well. These are the giants. These, you stand on the shoulders of these giants, right? Authors like this and Seneca and Livy and all these others, they lived in this wonderful time where people did it right. If they were pre Christ, there would be some commentary on that. Well, maybe they didn't get religion right or something, right. But these are, they are auctoritas. They are authority. We need to listen to them and respect them no matter what they say. And it's only by understanding what they say first can you then move on to now say new and original things. And that gets you down, you know, if somebody listens to this and they're an expert in literary culture or cultural studies, they may be like, oh, wait a minute. You know, there's all kinds of permutations to it, right? But if you want to talk about general medieval mindsets, huge respect for ancient authorities, so much so that that, you know, just having these volumes, it's worthy of mentioning in a writing. You know, our library has this, it has this, it has this. You may not, you may disdain them. You may say, well, they're not Christian. They were, you know, Greek pagan writers. You may criticize them and whatnot, but you have to recognize them. And if you use the, it's sort of a name dropping's a little too casual, but you see an awful lot of authors who will name drop and say, well, I have, in order to write this book, I have consulted the works of so-and-so and so-and-so and Plutarch's lives of these and things. And it almost becomes a credibility bit. If you are well-educated, you're exposed to authors like this. Because Vegetius self-identifies as a Christian, although I've never found anyone who's put down in language, you know, we can trust him or we should read him because he was Christian, not in a medieval writing. Could be out there. I've not encountered it. I have to imagine that's part of the mental gymnastics for at least some of these people saying, you know what, it's not like reading something like the few bits of Aristotle they had before the 13th century and saying, I have to wonder about this guy. You say, well, this is a Christian writing these things. And that helps you get over hurdle. But I think that that part is something that is very important in the medieval period, recognizing the auctoritas of those classical authors.
Yeah, and there is an irony, I think, in the way you present this. You know, if I were to describe, I think, his two big themes, one of them is about this dichotomy that you touched on, the idea that it's both a temporal dichotomy and a sociological one, where he gives you this list of where you should get recruits from. They should be from the country. One of his favorite lines that he repeats several times, not from the city where they are innervated by luxury. Innervated by luxury is one of his trademark phrases. But interestingly, if later writers looked at this as the kind of the encyclopedia of the good days of Rome, That's not what Vegetius is talking about. He himself is saying, I live in the bad times. The good times were before.
Right.
So there's always this kind of golden age past dwelling that you see both with people who read it and then with Vegetius himself. And so there's a really interesting, like I said, kind of a temporal dichotomy that he builds, where he essentially says, my time is trash, this time of the imagined past and what we call the High Empire. So think like first century AD, second century. That was the good time with this old legion.
Right.
So I think you get both of those things. My time is bad. Sometime in the past was better. And there's this whole sociological argument that this kind of rustic, city dwelling, hardworking, farming, craft life is better than these wealthy, lazy people in the cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and later on, when you get into successive periods, and you talk about the late Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and people can have the same attitude and say, my life is terrible because I'm living through the Black Death or something,
right.
And it's the ancients; those were the glories of Rome,
right.
And that's what I want to read about, even if I'm not going to use the text. And we should make that distinction between
yeah.
And when we talk about classical. Transmission, classical reception in my field, right? You don't have to use the book necessarily. It's just important that you've read it
yeah.
and that you've been exposed to it. And even in the Renaissance, they're saying, the ancient world, we can maybe aspire to imitate it,
right?
We're going to build a church that looks like a Roman church. But the thought of exceeding it, it's sort of the height of pride, and it really takes quite a long time to get to the intellectual notion that we can actually do better than the ancients,
right.
Which is this strange conundrum. As I'll point out to students, you look at high Gothic architecture; it is technologically superior to Roman architecture in every way.
Yeah, it's not a bunch of heavy stone bricks with no windows.
It is. It's amazing what they were able to do, and yet when you get some money in Rome and you want to build new buildings, you want to build the Duomo in Florence or something, you're going to build a Roman style
Romanesque.
Building. It's technologically worse, but it's Roman.
Right.
And I think that encapsulates kind of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I refer to that as the Golden Age fallacy, because it is a fallacy. People died on the streets of Rome of plague, just like they did in the streets of
Genoa. Life in Rome was actually very often terrible.
Yes.
But it's not looked at that way.
Never mind the fact that half the population was enslaved.
Well, yeah, of course. Everyone idealizes, the good times. They take the best pieces of those
right.
times, right? So you take the famous building or the famous battle or, that moment, and then you say, wait a minute, how many people were they crucifying? And
right. Yeah, people tend to forget. Vegetius was as far from the time period he was talking about as we are today from the founding of America. I mean, it was a huge amount of time.
Right.
I think the other part of it is, as you talked about, kind of the main way medievalists receive Vegetius is, this is in the end of, the beginning of Book 3, 63 of the Milner Translation, the money quote. Therefore, he who desires peace, let him prepare for war.
Right.
He who wants victory, let him train soldiers diligently. He who wishes a successful outcome, let him fight with strategy, not at random. No one dares challenge or harm one who he realizes will win if he fights. I think that's a pretty clear thesis statement, although towards the end of the book.
Right. And that's the, we have the motto of this institution, which riffs off of that. And,
yep.
And then it's always funny, the supposed Einstein quote, and I've never chased it down before, but you see it on bumper stickers. One cannot simultaneously prepare for and prevent war.
Yeah.
And Vegetius is saying exactly the opposite.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a lot of people quote that if you want peace, prepare for war,
mm-hmm.
or paraphrase, without realizing it comes from Vegetius. People don't understand this is where it's from.
Yeah.
He invented the phrase as far as we could tell.
Yeah.
All right, so I think we've covered his key ideas. Let's talk about transmission, as you were saying. This is usually described as the only surviving comprehensive Roman military manual.
Right.
And that each of those words is important. So Vegetius was not the only person to describe a high Roman legion. Why is it that this book in particular becomes so important as the centuries go?
I think because it is laid out like a manual. frankly. Mm-hmm. You can read Roman histories and you can read Greek histories of Romans, and you can look at how legions were put together and how they operated and those sorts of things, right? But to do that, you have to read a lengthy history, and you have to find those moments, and people certainly did. They did it. You can read Julius Caesar and see what he did, but it's in a different format. This reads like a guidebook, mm-hmm. and people like guidebooks. And I think that's part of the reason for its success. Now, you know, as you said, those words are all loaded, right? We haven't yet mentioned Sextus Iulius Frontinus, yep. right, who wrote the Stratagemata earlier in the first century AD. Supposedly, he had a book like this one, and it's lost.
Right.
Right? And if you read Frontinus, who was very popular in the Middle Ages, it's all military anecdotes.
Yep.
It's all stories. And then this general did this, and this is what happened. Ha, ha, ha. Right? And
yeah.
goes through all these. It's a lot harder to read. It just doesn't tell you, here's how you put together an army, here's how you march, here's how you camp, here's how you fight. And I think the prescriptive nature of it is part of that enduring popularity. If you say you have to read, you know, how many pages are in Livy?
Too many.
And we've lost much right. of Livy, right?
Right.
Or if you have to read somebody like a Polybius writing about right. the Punic Wars.
Who embeds this wonderful description of a Punic legion in the middle of this sociological, you know, political yeah. theory chapter.
Yep. You have to get it. And also, we tend to think about it today. Because we're living in the 21st century. You know, I'm going to go down to the bookstore. I'm going to buy some Polybius. I'm going to buy right. some Livy. I'm going to buy every Penguin edition of the classics, and I will have a larger library of classics than virtually any medieval writer.
Right.
right?
And not to mention, I think it's, 160 books of Livy?
Yeah. And I can do that because it's all translated into English. And so when you talk about getting your hands on a Polybius, well, that's all well and good if you can read Greek,
yep.
right? If the Greek has been translated into Latin, and there are Greek classics in the Middle Ages that are translated into Latin.
If they're translated well.
Yeah, if they're translated well, and if they are obtainable. Because, frankly, you're in the age where it's all copying by hand.
Yep.
And sometimes these books are hard to get a hold of. But a book that looks like a practical suggestion, that's going to get copied, and it's not going to get copied just because some monk decides that military matters are important. They're probably not thinking along that wavelength, right?
Yeah.
But I'll give you a couple examples. So, for example, in the early Middle Ages, the cleric Rabanus Maurus, who's one of the early transmitters of Vegetius, he prepares an edition at the request of his king, Lothar II. Right, so you have a monarch who says, "Hey, I've heard about this book mm-hmm. that I think could be really useful for me. Could you make a copy of it?" Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's another example of this. There's a guy named Freikulf who does the same thing for King Charles the Bald. I would like an edition of Vegetius because it has a practical application.
Yeah.
Whereas, yes, you'll have somebody like Napoleon who comes along, as you know, later in his life, decides to edit the classic right. Roman texts and stuff,
right.
because he knows there's value in there, right? But I don't think a Merovingian king with little learning understands that the collected works of Livy really have something to offer his army. What has something to offer his army is this thing that looks like a manual
mm-hmm.
that prescribes step-by-step actions to take to build and control an army.
It's also sitting on the table in front of both of us, and I can put my mug on it. Like, it's not a big book.
It's not huge.
Yeah.
Nope.
And especially yep. if you leave out that fourth book, which a Merovingian may not care about naval warfare.
Mm-hmm. And if you realize, if you look at manuscripts, the presentation matters too.
Mm-hmm.
When these things are copied, you'll very often see those section titles
mm-hmm.
Within each book, the different chapters. They are often, they begin with large illustrated or illuminated uncials.
Mm-hmm.
They are in a different, the last one I looked at, the chapter headings are in red ink. To distinguish them, so it's literally, if your Latin is good, or later on, when you get copies translated into like French vernacular, specifically for kings, you can scan them very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You can scan through, okay, I need to know what I need to think about in terms of supplying a march. Read through, nothing here, nothing here, turn the page, nothing here, and you see those headings, right?
Yeah.
Which is not something you can do with Livy and with Plutarch and with some of these, yeah. even with Caesar, you can't really do it because Caesar very much goes chronologically.
Yeah.
Right. So I think there's a manuals are very useful. And we think about doctrine these days, and you pop it open, you look at the table of contents, you look at the index, you find your definition for relative advantage, which you've been wanting to pin down, and there it is.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. The listicle is something that the military mind appreciates. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's focus a little bit on that word surviving, because that's a key part of Vegetius and his transmission. The core ideas are valued, but there's also kind of an attritive process of, Vegetius and pretty much every classical writer references other manuals, in particular by Cato is kind of the tentpole one.
Yeah.
So what happens to Roman books? That, you know, Vegetius probably could go to a library and find a wall of military manuals. We only have his now. So throughout the, particularly the early medieval period, how do we go from one to the other? Libraries full of Roman military manuals to one surviving.
Yeah, it's tough, right? And we don't always know the slow passage of time, the violence of their days, what I mentioned at the beginning, the loss of institutional support. And you can kind of let your mind run wild, but if you imagine a Roman town mm-hmm. that has a bit of a library in it, that has a school, that has a bath, that has a population. As the empire crumbles and transitions, as people move out, other people move in. If they are literate, not literate, what are their needs? I mean, and we don't know these individual stories, but it's not too crazy to say, it's this town in this field and it's cold and I need to make a fire and, you know, here's some things that burn. We just don't know.
Yeah.
Floods, catastrophes, bad storms, dilapidated roofs.
Yep.
It doesn't take much. A roof comes in, a few bouts of rainfall,
mm-hmm.
and your library's ruined. I have a colleague who it was terrible. He had a water pipe blow in his basement, which mm-hmm. ran right above his bookshelves. And, at that point, it's all over. If you don't get to them soon and you get those pages aired out and separated, it's right. It gets destroyed. And so it is interesting how these things don't survive, where we have residues of them. And we know that there were these books written by these authors because multiple people are talking about them.
Right.
But the copies aren't out there. Part of me hopes that we'll find them eventually.
Yeah.
Much of Aristotle is, politics was lost until the 13th century, Aristotle's politics, until it was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we'll get them back someday, but a lot of them just go away. And it really is the chance and probability, to use Clausewitz's term. So
yeah.
the example I always go to is our manuscript for Beowulf,
mm-hmm.
Which everybody knows, great, heroic story. Written in West Saxon, Beowulf fights Grendel. Grendel's mother fights the dragon. There's only one copy. There's one copy. And that copy was actually in the Cotton Library fire back in, I always forget if it was the 18th or 19th century, that sets fire to all these books. And there are scorch marks on the pages. But somebody happened to grab and secure the book. And so we have Beowulf.
Mm-hmm.
Had that fire gone and nobody retrieves the book, there would be no Beowulf, and undergraduates all over the country would be spared having to try to understand what it means. Beowulf,
right.
famous, even the first word is argued about, right? And so you just think of how many books are there that did not get saved. A more recent example is the fire at Notre Dame in Paris,
yep.
right?
Yep.
You have all these sacred relics on the inside, and the fire, you don't get in there and save that stuff. It's gone. And we tend to assume, because we have lived for centuries in the world of the printing press, that there are thousands, if not millions, of copies of books.
Mm-hmm.
And there just weren't, because they had to be copied by hand. So you might have a good spread of where there's 400 or 500 copies.
Right.
That's fantastic. That's for all of Europe.
Yeah.
That's really not that many,
right.
and it doesn't take that many disasters to get rid of it entirely.
Well, even more recently, I want to say there were something like 150 copies of the Declaration of Independence made, and only like 15 of them still exist.
Yeah,
which is wild to think about.
Well, it's tough. Magna Carta. There was an attack on one of the copies a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
and it was one I'd seen before. I'm like, and I remember seeing it and thinking, boy, that's pretty. I don't know if anybody was even watching it at the time. It's pretty exposed.
Yeah,
and then I read, years later of somebody going after it, there's not actually that many of these important documents. The benefit for us is, well, it's been copied and printed
right.
a million times.
Now
so
digitized.
So we'll never lose the text, but you could lose the base text, the actual.
Right. And that's important for these texts because one of the things we can do now is we can use technology to read layers of text.
Right. Because these texts are very often copied over other
other
texts, these so-called palimpsests, right? Where they scraped off the pagan classical piece to
Aristotle.
Yeah, to put in a another Book of the Hours.
Right, another Bible.
Right, yeah. Which, you know, by itself, given what we were talking about earlier, is interesting. There are some classic texts that are absolutely revered and you must preserve them, but we don't want to impute that attitude to everybody in the medieval world.
Right.
Just because there's a general attitude of we stand on the shoulders of giants doesn't mean that new monk Roger, who just got his position in the scriptorium, has a sophisticated understanding of that, and he may see a classical text and he says, you know what, it's on this vellum, I'm going to scrape off a layer,
yep.
and I'm going to write the psalm on top of it.
Yep.
Just as practice.
Individuals
don't always know the gravity of what they're doing. So, and that's one of the dangers, and my colleagues who do manuscript studies are generally very good at pointing these things out, that you can't assume, even in a scriptorium, that everybody in there copying has the same intellectual capacity, the same curiosity, the same love and reference for the text. They simply don't.
Yeah, and they may have their own agendas. You know, book burners exist at any time, so maybe they thought it was a good thing to replace, as you said, the pagan with the Christian. Or, you know, in other context, the pagan with the Muslim.
Well, the bishops in France got very mad that Aquinas was teaching Aristotle.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
and not just there. So let's talk specifically about Vegetius, kind of in this world of decaying Roman knowledge. I think you highlighted the two reasons he survives. One, pure chance. And two, because there was an interest in this. It is a manual. It is an epitome, to use the original word. So how do you see Vegetius used in the medieval world from the late antiquity through the high medieval period?
It's interesting that, and there's a fight about this. If you want to see him used in a practical military sense, there's an awful lot of hoops you need to jump through, a lot of causal chains you need to prove. Was there a copy of this text in a library near General A?
Right.
Did General A know that the book was in the library? Did General A go to the library to read the book? Did he read it? Did he understand it? Did he use it? And do we have proof of any of that?
Right.
And usually the answer is no, right?
Right.
We can usually identify, and I did some of this early in my career, here are where the manuscripts are. Here's where they're physically located. Mm-hmm. The first work I did on was King Henry II of England. There are copies at Angers. There are copies in Toulouse. There are copies in Poitiers. You know, all of these places you can find it. Here's where he was probably educated. Here's the names of his teachers. And at the end of the day, you can't really prove, right? Mm-hmm. Now, there are some occasions where you can actually put a copy in people's hands. There are several military men and possibly women who had access to it and even had a copy of it. Mm-hmm. One example is Thomas Becket, who is not known as a great leader of men, but he was a commander for a short time, and he did have a copy of Vegetius. And we know this because it is used in his letters, right?
So in that case, you do have the smoking gun.
You do, but on the other hand, the plot always thickens, right? Okay, so we've got his letters. Well, who wrote the letters? Did the archbishop write them all himself, or was it his clerk, John of Salisbury, who read Vegetius and quoted Vegetius extensively? Was that John putting words in his mouth?
Yeah.
But between the two, we know they had it, and we know they were quoting it. So in that case, you say, okay, so here's a commander of men who is very close to the text, who probably read it, or at least parts of it. Becket's education is always argued about. Right. It's not quite as good as we used to think. Did they put it into action?
Right.
And this is tricky. And there's one example of Henry II's father, Geoffrey Plantagenet, supposedly using the De Re Militare. So as the story goes, he's attacking a castle. He decides to consult the book, and as a result of the book, he lobs incendiaries at this wooden fort as a technique, right? And then you realize that there's nothing really about it doing that in Vegetius, right? So you have somebody who says, well, he consulted the book. Did he? Well, yeah, maybe he did. Did he take its advice, or did he have his own idea?
Right.
Was it all made up? You know, was the chronicler even there? If they were, or are they just making up a good story about their count? There's just so many things that you don't know. But what we do know is that it does pop up in other military writings. Mm-hmm. So whether or not anybody operationalized it, we do know that the knowledge is being carried forward.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And you have you mentioned John of Salisbury. You have a lot of medieval military theorists. Christine de Pizan also comes to mind, who seem like they're at least educated by Vegetius, or I've read some analyses that accuse Christine in particular of simply plagiarizing Vegetius, that her Book of Deeds of Arms and Chivalry is just Vegetius for knights. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, well, she's definitely, here's the thing, plagiarism means something very different today than in the older world. It was not considered plagiarism. Mm-hmm. Most of these authors gave credit where credit was due and then would copy huge sections of the text, right? It would be more like having one footnote to cover them all, right? Christine makes no bones about it. She names Vegetius.
Right.
She has a few principal sources she relies on. Two of them are manuals. One is Vegetius. Another is Bouvet's Tree of Battles,
yep.
Right? Where she takes huge chunks from it. But she says, according to Vegetius. We even know that she's using a French vernacular copy of Vegetius, and she says it quite clearly.
In
so,
the Burgundian court, if I remember right?
You got me there. I forget in the moment.
I think it's the Burgundian court.
It's the Foulache edition.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't call it plagiarism. I think what it speaks more to is that I think the bigger question about somebody like Christine is, if you are mostly using Vegetius for the first two books of your book, mm-hmm. how original a military thinker are you really? Because then some people will say, well, you know, clearly she's the first major female military writer, which, mm-hmm. you know, of these kinds of manuals, which is fantastic. But then you say, but most of it is borrowed from other sources. Mm-hmm. So do we want to call her a theorist? Do we want to call her a compiler?
A redactor, maybe.
A redactor. Yeah. We know that Christine was to some degree profit motivated, wanted her books read, and actually created the so-called autographs that were meant mm-hmm. to be sold.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe she has those motivations. And at the same time, you come back and say, okay, well, so what? For specialists, that matters. You say, well, we want to know more about Christine and why she wrote and what she wrote and what her technique was and her influence and all that.
Yeah.
For somebody who's interested in the canon of military authors, say she's transmitting mm-hmm. military information from different texts in the, if not the popular sphere, certainly the educated lay sphere, right? And that's valuable
mm-hmm.
and that's important. How original was she? That's an interesting and separate question.
Mm-hmm.
But she is undoubtedly one of those kind of major transmitters. And so it's interesting when you have these every once in a while, they pop up and they copy huge sections and push it forward. But even if they don't copy huge sections, you know, you mentioned John of Salisbury. He does quote Vegetius quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I would not say substantially.
Hmm.
He's not excerpting huge paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
He is, you know, he has a sentence or two at a time. He is not transmitting the entire text. Christine does far more to transfer actual core Vegetian stuff than
right.
John does. But what John does is he calls attention to this book. And he says, if you want to know about war, go and read this guy. And so you can read John's works and say, okay, I'm not getting a lot from Vegetius in here,
mm-hmm.
but I'm getting the reference.
Mm-hmm.
And so that reference is important. And you read John's work, it's just political and is popular in its own way.
Yeah.
That exposes you to this other manual. And then you see it in the library. You say, oh, that's the one, right? And so it's not just keeping the text alive, it's keeping the name
mm-hmm.
alive.
Do you think for the places you see Vegetius cited in the medieval period, do you think they're doing the kind of classic appeal to authority, or do you think they genuinely see the book as an authority?
I think it's both. You have to look at who the author is, right? What does John of Salisbury know about war? Well, he was never in one. He wasn't a soldier. He was trained for the priesthood. What does Christine de Pizan know about warfare? Well, she's from an elite family that's in Italy and moves to France. She writes for the king. So she certainly has exposure to court, but she is not Joan of Arc. She's not out there fighting, right? So it's always hard to know if whether... I tend to think it's the respect for the classical authority first and then the usability second. I can't be confident I'm always right about that. But I think when these authors stumble on something that says, hey, a military manual, this is probably useful. Whether or not this is up to date and the most useful thing is always kind of a separate question.
How do you see it relating to other manuals? You mentioned one for Titus. There's also Maurice's Strategicon from the later Eastern Roman Empire. So how do you see Vegetius weighted with the other kind of classical or immediate post-classical works?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because it does branch off. We, you know, we tend to, sometimes we talk about Vegetius in terms of really the Western tradition, which is interesting. I mean, he is writing it probably in Italy. And so it's definitely of kind of Western provenance, right? But it does get excerpted by the Greeks, by in the Eastern Roman Empire. Not as much as you would think, but it does show up. So it will pop up in Maurice's Strategicon, Maurice's text, because you start what I call the Byzantine doctrinal tradition, and that's a loaded word. But there's very much a carrying forward of Byzantine military thought from Maurice to Leo the Sixth, the Wise, to some anonymous treatises, you know, up forward into the up into the high medieval world, and they're collected from lots of Greek texts, classical texts, of Vegetius being one of them, and so you do have this transmission through the East into all of these different texts, and so it does carry on in the West. Which we have tended to concentrate more on, and there's lots of reasons for that. To do the Greek stuff justice, you really need to read Greek scholarship, and it's steadily becoming more accessible to Western scholars. But for a long time, it not so much. And the Byzantines have their own kind of martial traditions that they build into it, right? So instead of, you know, in the West, you'll see, well, Vegetius, if he gets copied, it's sort of kind of pure, right? So here's the chapters, and we make another copy of that, and somebody consults them, right? But for the Greeks, he gets incorporated. So here's some stuff from Vegetius, and then we're going to add to that what we know already, and he becomes part of a larger tapestry that I think is much more complicated. Because they build it into, well, but Byzantine formations look like this, and Byzantine command structures look like this, and they're of course not using the word Byzantine. And this is how we use our cavalry and our infantry, and everything's centered on the defense of these cities and the field armies and diplomacy and all these other kind of, you know, the continuance of the empire. And so he gets buried in a sense. He becomes part of a long-running doctrinal tradition, whereas in the West he gets. He kind of stays whole, and is discovered by writers in sequence and carried along, sort of pure.
He's kind of rediscovered by each generation.
And that's a good way to put it, I think. And so that leads you to different places, right? So, so when you get a Christine de Pizan, she can say, "Well, I'm just going to grab Vegetius. I'm just going to use that." Whereas a late Byzantine writer is going to be much more interested in what is the collective wisdom of our traditions, particularly because Byzantine military literature is much more attuned to the adversary. You mentioned Vegetius, he mentions Huns. He mentions Huns, Maurice has an entire section on, if you're going to fight the Huns, here's what they look like, here's how they fight, here's what their weapons are like, here's their tactics, here's how you beat them, and now let's talk about the Avars, and now let's talk about the Lombards, and now let's talk about the Bulgarians, right? And that tradition goes along and along and along in the literature, and so it just becomes they're very different sorts of texts. They're primers. Byzantine texts are primers on, sure, prescriptive military stuff, but also on the people you're going to be fighting. And because of the location of Constantinople, they're much more heavily weighted in terms of naval affairs. Mm-hmm. The land warfare is important, but so is the seaborne, right. Because they have, you know, centuries of fighting off fleets that are sailing on their cattle.
Right, yeah, and of course, when the Muslim armies and navies show up, it's the same thing, different people.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And yeah, the transmission talk is, and particularly the Byzantine aspect of it, is very interesting when you get into the early modern period, because then you see a shift away, I think, from Vegetius as whole text to Vegetius as being almost the godfather of militaries. It's this very weird thing that happens, particularly in France, which is what I'm most familiar with. The Renaissance starts in France in the 16th century. And they import all this classical stuff, largely Latin, because they don't do a lot of Greek reading. But then you have people like Erasmus floating around saying, no, you heathens who read Latin, you need to read this actual Greek, right? And thus you get the Textus Receptus and Christian history and all that. But that doesn't really penetrate France yet, because there are just so few Greek speakers and readers. Mm-hmm. They're really interested in this neoclassical thing. And so you get this weird little brother syndrome, where for about a century and a half, there's this belief that France is lesser than Rome, particularly the High Empire. This is the age of, you know, Francois I and Henri II. And that continues into the 17th century, where you get what's called the querelle between the ancients and the moderns, the quarrel. And the idea is, in literature, there's a group of people who say, we will never be as good as the Romans. And then you have these other people who say, no, modern French letters are just as good, if not better. And eventually the moderns win. But that doesn't happen in military affairs. Hmm. There's a great line from Christopher Duffy, who's kind of the dean of 18th century military studies, who says that Vegetius was an 18th century theorist. And one of the really interesting things that you said that I kind of latched onto was the idea that your authors don't say they're quoting from Vegetius. You kind of have to read it. My authors do. They say, mm-hmm. here's what Vegetius says.
Right.
And it's not so much. I think there's two things they take from Vegetius. One of them is the Golden Age thing. Things were better in the past, they're terrible now. Which fit the Enlightenment kind of mindset that, you know, things were better or could be better. But they also take the direct formations and tactics and all that stuff, and they say, Vegetius says we should fight in these seven linear formations. Here's how you do these seven linear formations with muskets. It's a one-to-one. They're not interpreting it. They're saying this is what we need to do verbatim. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like that Byzantine thing where they're being much more direct about how they use their history in
right.
a way.
Right. And if you couch it as, you know, if good fighting is good fighting.
Right.
And good formations are good formations. I mean, you know, there's a tradition of that. I mean, you're talking about France, but, you know, Machiavelli, mm-hmm. who, of course, becomes very popular in France and elsewhere, he's putting forward those formations.
Yep.
And he's, you know, and you could suggest he's reading too much Vegetius,
right.
because he pays very little attention to gunpowder. Mm-hmm. And how it could potentially change how armies fight. He wants to see this classically Roman thing, this citizen army and the militia and whatnot. And so you can idealize those formations and say, the Romans, why were they great? Well, because they discovered universal truths.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're universal, they're universal. It's, you know, it doesn't matter time and place. You can go ahead and repeat them. But it's interesting what you mentioned about reading the Latin, because you go to a place like Italy,
yeah.
right? And at the same time this is going on in France, Latin is falling hugely out of favor.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the vernacular, but it's also all about reading Greek, reading these Greek classics that have been lost for a long time, and finding out the wisdom that is in there.
Yeah.
And so you'll very often see people, they might reference a Latin classic or two, but really they're honed in more on the Greek.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you will see that you know, my favorite in when you look at more early modern manuscripts, mm-hmm. Certainly up to like 17th century ones, is these grand introductions they have in there where they'll actually come out and say, like somebody like Roberto Volturio or Eustace Lipsius or somebody, they'll have that frontispiece page that will say, for this work, I have relied upon, and they will name every single author that they used. And the really cool ones will be in some kind of art form. So they have like an inverted triangle where they're working down through all the names, right? And so that becomes a thing where you can look at it and you can say, oh, they use so-and-so and so-and-so. Now, it's interesting because once you start diving into those, some of those authors, like they say, well, they used Plutarch. Well, as I found in my research of John of Salisbury, what they're really using is a made-up story of Plutarch that he invented, right? So sometimes you get in that trap. But then the other problem is you get so used to it, you say, okay, they're naming all of their classical, and it's always the classical authors they're interested in, right? Then you get a guy like Machiavelli who doesn't do that. He refuses. He hardly ever names his sources. And that just drives you crazy because now you're sitting there saying, well, he's writing all these things. Clearly, you read passages, you say, that is definitely Vegetius, right? But he's not. He's never citing it. And that has led to Machiavelli's one of them. There are a few authors where scholars have gotten obsessed about what was their education, who did they learn from, what library did they use, so you can try to figure out where they got this. And an awful lot of speculation.
Yeah, one of the great things I ran into in writing my biography of Guibert was he actually says where he did his research. He tells you the libraries he went to, and you could go and look at their collections because that was the age when they started cataloging libraries. So you actually have where he went and how he did his research. But there's another great story from the period talking about the difference between early modern Italy and early modern France. There's a writer named Folard, who I kind of argue is the basis of modern military doctrine. And he wants to write an analysis of Polybius, but he doesn't read Greek. So he has to go to a Benedictine monastery to find somebody who reads Greek. So you have this funny work composed of a Benedictine who reads Greek but knows nothing about militaries, and a retired officer who knows everything about militaries and nothing about Greek. So you have this kind of telephone transmission. And then later there's a Prussian who is nicknamed Quintus Acilius Guischard, who comes back at Folard and says, you didn't read Greek, you got all this Greek wrong, because he read Greek. So by after 1750, you have a group of people who do read Greek. And that's when you see the first, I've found, first modern copy, I guess, or translation of Leo VI.
Right. Yeah, I've seen that as well. I think we talked about that a few months ago.
And
you start to see those translations appear in the weirdest places. I gave a talk a little while ago on a book by Rogers, Naval Warfare Under Oars, where he has an English translation of Leo VI. And kind of tracing back and saying, where did these come from? And it came originally from a French manuscript, of the gentleman you're talking about, where they took it and did a translation and kind of put it in. It's funny where these things pop up. Now, by the time you get to that point, the 20th century, they're citing.
Right.
Now it's late 19th, early 20th century citing is interesting because you'll go like 3-4 pages and there'll be one footnote at the bottom,
right?
So it's sparse, but it's very spare in its treatment. But at least it's there, and you can say some of these things. The other thing I would point out is the importance of Vegetius that still gets to sort of recognize. Some of it's under the table and some of it's not. At the Army War College at Carlisle, they have an English vernacular version of Vegetius in their rare books library that they often have on display, from what I understand. And it's kind of it's one of the English versions that people knew about during the Revolutionary War and these later conflicts. Now, where they start, because there is a place, there is a certain point where it starts being looked at in a more antiquarian manner, right? That it holds its usefulness. And I would say reading Vegetius is useful all the way up through Frederick the Great. You're talking about the Western tradition, when I teach our History of Military Thought class, I have them read some Vegetius, because say that if you're talking about 18th century state warfare, limited armies,
linear warfare,
it's still applicable. It still gives you a flavor of what war was like. Yes, there's guns and things, and it's a little different, right? And I have argued that I have Clausewitz Dead to Right in at least two places where he is, and I would say, legitimately plagiarizing Vegetius, because he takes his material and does not give any credit whatsoever.
Right, and they knew better.
Right, and he should have known better, because he's citing other sources. But then it does eventually, you get to a place where you say, warfare has changed enough
yeah.
that this is an interesting thing. I don't know that it's necessarily as helpful. Mm-hmm. Those general maxims of don't, you know, how much risk do you assume? You don't want to waste your soldiers. You can't rebuild an army. Surely those still apply in a lot of contexts around the world.
Right.
But virtually the rest of it, if you want treatments of the soldier's condition, there are better books to read. If you want to know how to make a camp, this is it's out. It's clearly outdated. There's not as much useful stuff in there anymore. And so then they become display case things.
Right.
And then they sort of fall off. And I always kind of wonder if Fagetius will ever make kind of a, you know, be rediscovered again, mm-hmm. Because there's something in there that is, you know, we've overlooked for so long and figured we had the answer to, and maybe he's got a better one.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Yeah, and I think you touched on some of kind of the modern continuity of Vegetius. We are both holding modern translation editions of it, so there's still a market for it. I do think there is a misuse of it that is very current as well, too, and it's the same misuse that's been made of Vegetius for centuries. It's the same misuse that's made of Polybius. So we have two surviving descriptions of Roman units in detail, Western Roman units. The one in Polybius, where he describes the what may or may not be the legion of the Punic Wars. And then we have Vegetius's that he calls the Old Legion. In both cases, these are often presented as being the formation that Roman armies used during these time periods, whether the Punic Wars or the High Empire, or even during Vegetius's time. In reality, neither of them claims that that was the case. They say that this was kind of a typical idea rather than the idea that showed up on a battlefield. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the traps that Vegetius lays, as does Polybius, is to assume that this was a one-to-one correspondence with the way battles and wars were fought, instead of being kind of a paradigm that they strove for but often didn't necessarily reach. And we saw some of the same with Greek armies, the big debate over what the hoplite did and how hoplites worked.
Yeah.
So I do think you see some of that. And I think when people describe Roman armies today, and I'm not thinking so much scholars as I am, you know, public historians on YouTube, media like that, they are often doing Vegetius, whether they realize it or not.
Oh, yeah, I think so. And the whole idea that these are idealized texts, right? You know, this is, it's like when somebody says, you know, a Roman legion has, you know, this many soldiers. And you say, well, did they ever, right? You know, the number is always variable. Or it drives me crazy with the Mongols talking about the Tumans, and they were always like this. And
exactly 10,000.
Yeah, it's strange that, and it's, I can forgive, not that it's my place to forgive anybody, but I can forgive when people who are interested in the past, amateurs, history enthusiasts, even people who really like reading about war, they fall into these things, and it's fine because they're trying to imagine what the world was like before, and that's a really hard thing to do. And models help you do that. What I just find excruciating is when scholars fall into those things, people who should know better, where we are trained to be skeptical mm-hmm. of virtually everything we read, and yet we take things at literal face value. To me, that's just one of my pet peeves. It just drives me nuts. Well, and a Roman already did this.
Yeah.
And it is funny, and like you say, they may not even know where they got the impression, but they're repeating it from before. But yeah, these are idealized. You know, when. Surely, I mean, just think about like the setting up of camps, right?
Mm-hmm.
Vegetius gives you all of these dimensions, you know, and you want this many paces and this many things, you know, right. You build a wall around it like this and everything. You've got to imagine as the Romans are moving through the countryside, sometimes camp looks really nice and sometimes right. it's a pile of junk because
right.
there's not enough trees or the trees are bowed and you didn't bring enough saws or, you know, Quintus got drunk and he's the only one who knows how to carve the post just right.
Right.
It's always variable. It's always changing. So it's always good to have this. This is ideally what it looked like. And then, you know, what is the reality? It's almost like going to a Renaissance fair,
right?
Where everybody's wearing peasant blouses that are bleached to perfect white.
Yeah, right. And their teeth are all white.
And their teeth are all white and their hair, you know, they took a shower that morning. And you say, okay, right. I got it. Nobody really wants to live the way a medieval peasant lived because that's a horrible, treacherous lifestyle, right?
Right?
So you have to pull the ideal out, and it serves a purpose as long as we admit things aren't always as they were written.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Dr. Osler, it's been great. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.